for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Jodie Foster is a director, producer, two-time Academy Award-winning actress. She directs and stars opposite Mel Gibson in the new film, The Beaver. It's the story of a man dealing with an extreme case of depression. Walter Black's wife has kicked him out of the house. His older son hates him. Just when he's about to kill himself, he finds a beaver hand puppet, and it takes total control of his life.
Hello? The person who handed you this card is under the care of a prescription puppet. Walter, what the hell is this?
Henry, mate. Could she be the fine varnish we was talking about?
I'll get it.
Thanks, mate. Did you read your card?
Yes, I...
Read the card. Read the card.
The person who handed you this card is under the care of a prescription puppet designed to help create a psychological distance between himself and the negative aspects of his personality. Please treat him as you normally would, but address yourself to the puppet. Thank you.
There you go.
Is this some kind of a joke?
No, hardly, love. Nothing funny about it.
Stop it with the puppet. Right? I'm confused, Walter, and I need some answers right now.
Answers right now for Jodie Foster. You have called this film probably the biggest struggle of your professional career. Tell me what you mean.
Probably not for reasons you'd think, actually. It was a difficult film. I think it was difficult getting the tone right. It has a very odd tone to it, which I embrace and think is wonderful. It has a lot of lightness to it, and certainly the original conceit of a man who puts a puppet on his hand sounds like a high-concept conceit, but in fact it is quite a dark drama. And kind of marrying those two things, the lightness of the beginning and the descent of the character, is struggle. And the natural movement towards tragedy and towards drama in the film, I think, was the hardest thing for me.
His depression and his, I mean, he's on the verge of self-destruction.
Yeah.
Every minute of that film.
Yeah, he's a man who's struggling. And I think it's something that many of us understand. I think many people, myself included, have depression in their family and have had lots of varying degrees of connection with depression. This is chemical depression, which is much more serious and something that talk therapy can't cure. I mean, he needs a much more serious therapy than that.
Tell me why a beaver.
Why a beaver? Good
why
question.
A beaver?
Well, it is absurd. I mean, why an English accent? It could have been any puppet. And I think that's what's wonderful about the movie is it doesn't matter. It's a man who's trying to dissociate from himself, who's trying to change, who's trying to not be who he presently is. And in order to do that, he has to put himself inside a different character. It's a survival tool, really. And the beaver is a very industrious animal. It does lots of things with wood. It makes things. It produces things. And it has sort of, you know, it has tangible results, but it also destroys things.
But Mel Gibson was, in reality, having a very hard time either right before you started this film or while you were making it.
Actually, not at all. I think he was as happy as a clam while we were shooting the movie, and any of his issues really happened after the film was finished and during reshoots. Some portion of reshoots, but I love the man. I've known him for many, many years. We're very close, and I think professionally he's probably the most loved person I've ever worked with. Maybe Chow Yun-Fat is also incredibly loved, but he's incredibly professional. He's brilliant. He's directed incredibly, incredibly beautiful films. And I can't think of anybody else that could inhabit this character the way that he did.
Here's a message posted on Facebook by Wes. Says, we absolutely love Jodie Foster. She's magnetic, riveting, goes on and on. But even more than adoring her work, we respect Jodie for standing up for what she believes in, even when it goes against the norm and what others think, as in the case of her friend Mel Gibson. Although it was not very Hollywood to come out in support of him, she showed she is truly a real friend. Bravo.
Well, I am a real friend. I know the man. I love him. And he's been incredibly loyal to me. And he's, you know, he's the man that I know, kind-hearted and deep and beautiful and trustworthy and loyal and all those things.
How did you first come to know him?
Well, we did a film called Maverick together many years ago, and I knew from the moment that I met him this was somebody I was going to love forever. But that being said, he's also just an extraordinary actor, and he's wonderful in the film. And I don't know if people can separate people's struggles, people's personal struggles from what they see on screen. And in some ways, he brings a lot of depth to this character because he does understand struggle.
He clearly has a strong role in this film mm-hmm. of yours. The question will be, will others mm-hmm. bring him in, or is his career on a downward trend?
I have no idea. This is not something I can know. I really don't know. I know, obviously, we have a different relation in America. We have a different relationship with people's public personas than they do in other places. And frankly, around the world, nobody really cares what problems he had with his girlfriend. I don't know. You know, we'll see. We'll see what happens.
What about the kinds of outbursts he's had, Jody? Mm-hmm. I mean, how have you felt about those outbursts? No matter where they've gone or to whom they've gone?
I don't know. I mean, there's a part of me that feels like they're none of my business. It's not a side of Mel that I know particularly. And, you know, I mean, I did see him get hit in the head, and when blood came out of his head during the shoot, he definitely, you know, was in pain, and it hurt. And so I have seen that side of him. You know, when you stub your toe or you get hit in the testicles, things happen. But what did I think? I thought it was none of my business. You know, as I've said to him before, I'm happy to see you in your underwear, but I'm not interested in seeing you in your underwear against your will.
So you've never asked him about his own personal life and his inability, for example, to control his temper?
I know a lot about his personal life, and I've asked him a lot about his personal life, as he has mine. I mean, that's what people are. But
who are friends.
That's right, and that's why it's private. I think, yeah, my private relationship with him really doesn't have much to do with any of this. And I do know that, you know, I know the man that I know, who's supportive and kind and lovable and loving and is an extraordinary actor. And I think that all of those things come into play as an actor and as an artist. And I think that's what you see on screen. And hopefully people will be able to embrace the film for what it is.
Jodie Foster. She's director, producer, two-time Academy Award-winning actress. Her films Taxi Driver, The Accused, Silence of the Lambs, Little Man Tate. I love that movie. She directed and stars in the new film, The Beaver. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. You've talked about your own struggles with depression in the past. Were you able then to bring your own experience to the movie?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I have talked about my own struggles with depression very much. I think I know a bit about it. I know a lot about it.
You've said it's part of your life.
I think it is a part of our life. I think it's a part of everyone's life, honestly. And anybody who's an artist, one of the things that you bring to the table as an artist is the ability and the necessity to ruminate, you know, to think about things deeply. And if you don't think about things deeply, you're probably not going to be very good. If you're a writer and you just type something and then you hand it in and say, well, I'm done, not much happens. I think it requires to really be, to try to be an excellent artist. I think it requires depth of feeling and depth of connection. And I think in the long term that can be very depressive. But it also allows you to evolve through tragedy and evolve through experiences in ways that other people who just went to the beach instead just didn't have that opportunity.
So the total of life experience including depression, has to come through.
Yeah, I think, and the film talks about that, which is, you know, this is a roller coaster, and life is hard. It's heavy, and it does get heavier as you get older. You know, your parents age, your children have problems. Life is heavy, and it also is can be blissfully light. But you take both of those things together.
Your acting career, you have said at one time. Mm-hmm. You were finished with acting, and you changed your mind.
I don't think I ever said I was finished with acting. I definitely went to college, like lots of college students. I have been working in the business for 45 years, so there are times where I burn out a little bit, and I'd like to do it a little less. Yeah. I don't think I'll ever be done with it. I think it's something that I'll always return to. I think this particular moment in my life, I'm probably less interested in spending as much time in front of the camera as I did before. I think I'm more interested in being behind the camera. And one of the reasons why I do continue to act mostly is because I'm so interested and fascinated by the directors that I work with, and I'd like to find out more from them.
How long did making The Beaver take?
It was quick. I think it was a pretty quick, it was about 3 months.
Mm-hmm. Real?
Well, production is 3 months. Of course, prep is longer, and post is longer.
And it was not a terribly expensive movie?
No, this is an independent film. It's made with a modest budget and, intended for a very specialized audience in some ways.
When we come back, we'll talk about some of the other movies that Jodie Foster has been in and hear some clips. 800-433-8850. And with me here in the studio, Academy Award-winning actress Jodie Foster. She has directed the new movie, The Beaver, which stars, along with Jodie Foster, Mel Gibson. And you can join us, you can call us, send us an email, join us on Facebook or Twitter. As a director, your movies have focused on family dramas. Talk about why that is of such interest to you.
Yeah, clearly it's something that I'm obsessed with. I think if I was going to do a sci-fi movie about Martians, it would be a Martian family, I'm sure. it just seems, I'm sure lots of actor directors are interested in psychology. That's why we become actors. And it really is the basis of psychology for me. I love the tapestry of how people, the dynamic of how people change each other by how they touch one another. And that always brings me back to the family.
What about your own family life as a child growing up? Tell me about that.
I guess it was different than most kids. I think it was, wonderful, but it was different. I was a child actor. I started at the age of 3. My brother had been an actor before me. I basically supported my family, and I had a single mom. Who was with me on sets and who inspired me, I think, to study, to go on, to have not just have a career, but also to go on academically. And Well, what else can I tell you? It was fun. It was good. It was a good thing. I don't look back, even though it changed my life in ways and made me different. I'm sure left huge scars. I don't think those scars are so bad.
Yeah. What about your brother?
Mm-hmm. My brother was an actor. He quit acting. I think his acting kind of tapered off by the time he was 18, 16, 16 to 18, it tapered off. And he went on to do a variety of other things in his life.
Do the two of you still have contact?
No, not much. I know his kids, though. I know his. He has lots of children.
So interesting. Kids. Lots of children.
Many children, yes.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. That's wonderful. But you decided you wanted to go on to college, to Yale. What did you study?
I studied literature at Yale, and specifically I did a lot of African-American literature and stuff like that.
Yeah. What about psychology?
I was terrible at psychology. Isn't that interesting? Because, you know, maybe I just picked the wrong courses.
It gets into a lot of numbers.
There was a lot of statistics.
Yeah,
and that
right.
was really of no interest to me.
Right.
But, you know, my first love really is reading. And I love books. I love literature. And I found that in everything, you know. And I felt like that in some ways has been the perfect field to study for directing and for acting. Because it's about deepening into the human experience.
In the movie, The Beaver, you have two sons.
Yes.
One's a teenager, totally unenchanted mm-hmm. with his father. Yeah. The younger one, so sweet, mm-hmm. so accepting mm-hmm. of the flaws he sees in his father. You have two sons.
Mm-hmm.
How old are they?
My sons are 12 and a half and 9. And I love the relationship in the film of the sons to their father and to their mother. And I felt like it was incredibly well observed. The older son, the 17-year-old son, who's just about, he's looking to going to college. He has, he's starting to fall in love. And the one thing that he wants more than anything is to differentiate himself from his father. And he feels like he's unfortunately genetically predisposed to just become exactly like him. And he's trying to do anything he can to fight against that.
And he grows.
Yes, he does. Film is equally divided between Anton Yelchin's character and his father, Mel Gibson's character. And you're sort of watching two stories at the same time, stories that are in collision. I think two men that if they were able to reunite and if they were able to rediscover their relationship, that perhaps they would be able to cure each other of what's wrong with one another.
Early on in the film, the older son says to you, his mother, "You know, I thought you were going to throw him out for good, and yet here he is back with this beaver on his hand."
Well, yeah, it's something that the son doesn't understand,
you know,
the commitment that a husband and wife can have towards each other. And, you know, in this film, Meredith, my character, she loves him. And when you love somebody, you struggle with them. There are lines that she draws, and the line that she draws is, "I will not let you take down my children." And the second that you're crippling psychology starts affecting my children is the day that I will leave you.
Mm.
And she's very adamant about that, and that's exactly what she does, causes in some ways Walter, Mel Gibson's character, to choose between the beaver and his family.
You are both starring in the film and directing
mm-hmm.
the film. What is it that allows you to both be in it and watch it from afar?
It's a funny thing to act and direct at the same time,
yeah.
Kind of a little bit of a schizophrenia, but I think wonderful as well. I mean, you're able to make decisions, make intellectual decisions before you start the film to prepare the movie to have all of the benefits of the kind of preparation that you do as a director, and then walk on screen and do it in two takes and walk away. The bad news is you don't get as many choices as you might with other actors. You don't get as much inspiration as you might with other actors. But I think you do really, you know, nobody understands the essence of the character the way an actor does. But nobody understands the essence of the film the way the director does. So you get both things.
So, but you're keeping in mind so many things
yeah.
beyond the characters in the film.
Yeah, it's stressful, it's tiring, it's exhausting. It's why you need a big vacation at the end of it.
And did you take one?
Are you about to? I have never quite taken that wonderful vacation that I should have taken at the end of the movie. But, you know, Mel Gibson has also directed and acted in movies. When he did Braveheart, I remember saying to him, oh, I think this is a bad idea. Do you really want to do this? And he said to me when he finished, he was like, I'm never doing this again. And then, of course, you know, did it again.
I have a quote here that says, I don't do well with people who are not direct. Mm-hmm. Pardon me. I don't do well with passive, aggressive, wishy-washy.
Yeah.
So what does that mean when you run into a director who might be that way?
Passive-aggressive and wishy-washy?
Yeah.
Well, I have a real problem with that. It's very hard for me to it's especially difficult for me to make a film with a director that doesn't have opinions, a director who's relying on others to bring him ideas. That's
Can you
really
think of one?
I certainly wouldn't mention on the program. Yes, I can think of many in my
you
head, and it's a cruel joke to play on a crew and on a film, and
it never
turns out well.
Yeah, what happens when you've got a director who is not direct?
Someone else takes over. You find someone else takes over. I don't know. You know, there's a director for everyone. Personally, I like people who are direct and succinct and articulate. That for me is very helpful. I like somebody who has an intellectual approach as opposed to a very emotional approach. I feel like the emotions are my problem and that's my job, but his job is to articulate what he wants. But you know, there are other actors who like different things. I think the truth is you know when you're making a movie for those 4 months or 5 months that he's the head of the party and you are there to serve him, whether he deserves the job or not. So you kind of grin and bear it.
Do you ever challenge a director you don't agree with?
And I think they wait for that and they love that. I think they want to be challenged. I want to be challenged. I want people to come in and bring other ideas, things that I hadn't thought of. But in the end, you know, you are there to serve their vision. And if you are serving a vision you don't agree with, you're on the wrong movie to start.
Here's an email from Greg who says he'd like to know why you did not take part in the Silence of the Lambs sequel. Mm. And he goes on to say he's an avid soldier listening in Orlando. Uh-huh. He says, I think the film would have been a lot better with her.
Well, that's very nice of him. There are great actors in that film. Julianne Moore, who ended up playing Clarice Starling in that film. I actually wasn't available. I was starting a film and I wasn't available. But I think the director also did not, the original director, Jonathan Demme, did not take part in that. And there were issues about the original text and the original screenplay. And some of those things, if you don't understand the screenplay and you don't feel passionate about the screenplay, you really shouldn't jump aboard a film.
I still have shivers from this movie.
What was it?
It was screaming. Some kind of screaming, like a child's voice.
What did you do?
I went downstairs, outside. I crept up into the barn. I was so scared to look inside, but I had to.
What did you see, Clarice? What did you see?
Lambs. They were screaming.
They were slaughtering the spring lambs.
And they were screaming.
And you ran away?
No. First I tried to free them. I opened the gate to their pen, but they wouldn't run. They just stood there, confused. They wouldn't run.
But you could, and you did, didn't you?
Yes. I took one lamb and I ran away as fast as I could.
Where were you going, Clarice?
I don't know. I didn't have any food, any water, and it was very cold. Very cold. I thought if I could save just one, but he was so heavy. He was so heavy. I didn't get more than a few miles when the sheriff's car picked me up. Rancher was so angry, he sent me to live at the Lutheran Orphanage in Postman. I never saw the ranch again.
What became of your lamb, Clarice?
I killed him.
You still wake up sometimes, don't you? You wake up in the dark and hear the screaming of the lamb.
Yes.
That was a long clip.
That was a long clip. You know, what struck me about that, two things. That soft Southern accent that you developed for that film, and also hearing Anthony Hopkins pronounce that name, Clarice, with such careful enunciation.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's called The Silence of the Lambs because she is a woman traumatized by sound. And so it's turned her into somebody who whispers. Boy, you work in radio, so you know all about voice. The accent, of course, you know, she has the remnants of an accent from West Virginia, but she had to go live somewhere else. His relationship, Lecter's relationship with her to start out with, is in some ways deciphering everything about her personality based on her voice. So voice plays a big part in that movie. I have to say, if I was to reconceive my career, I don't mind telling you that I would have loved to have been a radio host. That would have been my thing that I would have loved to have done.
Really?
I would like to not put on any makeup and hair, and I'd like to wear my Birkenstocks, please, and come in. And I would have loved to have been a radio host.
And people say to me, how come you're dressed? You're on radio. But I dress every day, and I don't wear Birkenstocks.
Well,
I mean, I do at the beach, but
well,
whatever.
I would be wearing pajamas. Personally, I would be wearing pajamas. I did a film called The Brave One where I played a radio host, and there's something so freeing about it, something about just being a voice and in some ways inhabiting people's heads and getting inside their experience of the storytelling without all the distraction of how you look and the expressions on your face.
You're exactly right. And, you know, people have said to me years back, how come not television? And I said, because I think it's a distraction.
Mm-hmm.
I think radio is mind to mind.
No, I agree.
And really just gets in there.
I agree. I'm a big fan of radio, public radio, and I spend a lot of time in my car in the garage, not going into the house, just for that last segment of, you know, This American Life or something that I'm listening
to. This American Life is fabulous.
But as an actor, you know, I came about it a different way, and I find that I am moved by sound. And I'm moved by storytelling, by words. There are a lot of actors who can stand in front of a grave and go, oh, that's my grandpa, and they can just be moved and cry. But for me, I need words. And I learned that about myself early on.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I want to ask you about the movie, The Accused, because it was one that was disturbing to a lot of people, including the men who were involved in that rape scene.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them cried afterwards. Tell me about that.
Yes, making a movie is a very odd experience. You know, you take part in the words and the gestures that are dramatic and are real, and yet it's an unreal circumstance. So it's, you know, how do you make sense of those two things? You know, you have to be authentic and you have to feel the feelings, and yet it's not supposed to be real. So it was difficult, I think, for them, specifically for the men who played the rapists or the men who played the men who were egging on the rapists. It was difficult for them to dissociate themselves from the words and the gestures.
I want to prosecute the others. The ones who cheered and clapped. The ones who made it happen.
So you can make another deal?
No. I'm not going to make any more deals. If I prosecute the others, the rapists will stay in jail for the full 5 years. And the rape will go on record. The deal won't matter because the rape will go on record.
You really want to do that?
Only if you help me. I need you to testify.
I get to tell my story? Yes. You alone now? Yeah. I kicked him out, right? While I was laid up, he came back to pick up all of his stuff, you know? What's his is his, what's mine is his. Thank God he left me the radio. Anything I can do? Yeah. What? No deals. No deals. No deals.
See, some scenes don't translate on radio.
Jodie Foster. And that was a clip from The Accused. We'll take a short break. When we come back, time to open the phones. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. And by Constant Contact, offering an event marketing service that provides registration tools to small businesses and nonprofits. ConstantContact.com. This is NPR.
Do you leave the faucet on when brushing your teeth or soak the sidewalk as you water the lawn? On the next Fresh Air, The Future of Water, Charles Fishman, author of The Big Thirst, says we have to think differently about how we use this resource.
I think we're leaving the golden age of water in the developed world. Water that has been safe, unlimited, and essentially free.
Join us.
Welcome back. Jodie Foster is with me. She's a director, producer, two-time Academy Award-winning actress. She has a brand new movie out. It opens in May. It's called The Beaver, and also stars her dear friend Mel Gibson. Now we're going to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Durham, North Carolina. Good morning, Laura. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. Jody, my question is about Ted Levine, who co-starred with you in Silence of the Lambs.
Mm-hmm.
His acting talents really seem to be underappreciated, and I think he gave an extraordinary performance as James Gunn.
Mm-hmm.
In that film.
Mm-hmm.
What was your own experience working with him in Silence of the Lambs?
Yeah, Ted came on at the end. I didn't have much to do with him. I only had one series of scenes with him towards the end. And he's extraordinary. I see him all the time on TV, and he has that very, very, very distinctive voice. that you see on a lot of cop shows. I think that Silence of the Lambs was an extraordinary film for a lot of actors and for everybody, including the director of photography, the sound guy. I feel like it's the best work that any of us have ever done, and probably I think because the book was so beautiful that it inspired everybody to give so much in terms
of the
performances.
Have you ever wanted to do television?
Oh, I did television for many years. You know, I started when I was three, so I did a lot of television. I did commercials, I did cartoons, I did all that kind of stuff. I liked doing television as a training ground when I was younger. Hmm. Television's changed quite a bit now. We have cable stations, we have all sorts of new avenues for great talent. And in fact, now I would say there's more interesting things being done on cable than there is sometimes in features.
Let's go to Newport, Rhode Island. Les, you're on the air.
Hi. First and foremost, that Silence of the Lambs clip is, I think, even more frightening just listening to it than watching it. Yeah. And secondly, I hope the people at Sirius Radio heard this, and I hope they offer you a radio show.
Maybe at some point in my life, a radio show.
Would you take it?
I don't know if I would do the talk jock radio. See, I like the old Sirius radio.
Yeah,
I like that
exactly.
National Public Radio radio.
Right. Good.
My foremost question is, I used to be an assistant at ICM mm-hmm. in the early to mid-90s, and you were one of those, you know, artists that we always wished would come in so we can all see. And
I never did.
Of course, we were always stuck, you know, with Jean-Claude Van Damme and others, mm-hmm. all the other ones that we would hide from. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we always, you know, heard about, you know, scripts being offered to you and whatnot. And mm-hmm. and what is your process with respect to choosing mm-hmm. a script? Because as an actress, you know, I admire you terribly. Mm-hmm. I admire you even more by, you know, what roles you choose. But what's your process? And especially now mm-hmm. that you're being even more picky, if that's
right.
the word.
Well, I read a lot. And for me, you know, as I said, my first love really was literature and language and words. And I'm pretty discerning about the scripts that I take on. I have to have a personal connection with them, and I have to really believe that the blueprint that I'm looking at, the script that I'm looking at, is very close to what's going to be shot. So I have to really believe in it 100%. That's the first thing that I look at is the script, and then of course the second thing is the director. And those two things combined mm-hmm. are the two most important reasons why I take a film. A lot of actors are really just moved by the part. They just want to play that, you know. Oh, I could be on a motorcycle, or oh, I could cry a lot. I sometimes say, you know, I wasn't born to be an actor. I don't have an actor's personality. It's a job that I inherited in some ways, and so I don't fall into the category of somebody who's that lured necessarily by the character or by the part. I really look at the script, by the overall story that I want to tell, or that their director wants to tell, and by the director's vision.
He played a clip from The Accused mm-hmm. just before the break. Why did you feel so strongly about that one?
Why did I feel strongly about the movie, about taking the role?
Taking that role.
I really fell in love with that character, and I really felt that that character was somebody that I knew, you know, somebody that was in the wrong place at the wrong time and was stoic and had bravado. And in some ways, some of the things that I found the most beautiful about her, her truth and her strength and the fact that she wasn't an intellectual, those were the things that she was penalized for. You know, those were the things that she was punished for. She was punished for being too strong. And in some ways, that is what rape involves. It's less a sexual crime than it is a crime of power.
Well, I was going to ask you about the cause itself mm-hmm. and whether that moved you or to what extent it influenced you.
Well, I was young. I was only maybe 24, I think, maybe 25. And so I'm not entirely sure I had great conscious reasons for doing anything. I pretty much got up in the morning and ate breakfast and then decided to do movies from there. But I did understand that this character moved me and that the story moved me. I didn't entirely 100% understand why.
Here's an email from Judith in Falls Church, Virginia. First, she says, I love your work and I have the utmost respect for you and how you approach your craft and your life. But a question, what makes you laugh? What do you find belly aching funny?
I have a pretty weird sense of humor. I have I shouldn't say mean-spirited, but I have a dark sense of humor. And
give me an example.
I just watched again for, I don't know, I've probably seen it 25 times, the film Team America. I don't know if you've seen that movie. It's from the South Park group, and it's all with puppets, and it is so nasty. And so,
and it makes you laugh.
Oh my, yeah, it makes me laugh. Well, I think if you saw Kim Jong-il as a puppet singing the song "I'm So Ronri," it would make you laugh as well.
I think you're right. All right, let's go to Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Good morning, Tony.
Yeah, good morning, ladies.
Hi.
All my stars, Jodie Foster. I just wanted to say that my friends, family, and acquaintances are all in agreement with me when I say that you are a national treasure.
Thank you.
However, yes, oh, thank you. However, they aren't on board with me when, in my opinion, of your film Contact, which happens to be one of my all-time favorites.
Mm-hmm.
The character arc you display is phenomenal, and it's, for me, just breathtakingly faith-affirming film. For someone who struggled with issues of faith lifelong, it's helped me plug into that.
Mm-hmm.
And I, too, have a question regarding one of your co-stars in that movie, John Hurt, who I imagine you did not share the set with, but he happens to also be one of my all-time favorites. And Any feedback or remarks you might have about him as well?
Yes, I had one fabulous long scene with John Hurt, and that was a highlight in that film, Contact. Contact is a beautiful movie, and I think that character that he played is really, you know, incredibly well drawn. But that was Carl Sagan's life work. You know, he spent 10 years on that, writing that book. Mm. Before he wrote the book, he wrote the screenplay. And he himself said, look, the screenplay was no good, so I had to go write the book, and then eventually gave it to somebody else to write the screenplay. So he was on it for a long time, and he died during the course of the film, sadly, and he never really was able to see the film finished. But it bears all the traces of his entire life's work, and I think the struggle between faith and science, and how beautifully connected they can be. So when my kids say to me, you know, Mom, do you believe in God? And I say, I don't have a religion, and I don't believe in God the way lots of people do. But all of my answers really come from that film. I feel like that character of Ellie Arroway really articulates everything that I feel about faith and science and how they connect together.
Tell me about Little Man Tate.
Okay.
A movie I absolutely love.
Oh, thank you.
And the interaction between you and that young man.
Yes. Adam Hahn Bird is the name of the young boy who played Fred Tate in the film, a 7-year-old prodigy. It, you know, if there ever was a movie that was kind of the story of my life, I think that that film is really the story of my life.
You need a belt, kid?
No, I don't. I just need to tuck in my shirt.
You need a belt. Hey. How about if we just say, see you tomorrow? Is that a goodbye, huh?
If you send me the checkbook, I'll balance it for you.
I think I can take care of that, Freddy.
Who's gonna water the plants?
Hey, you forget about the plants, okay? Forget about the checkbook. You're gonna have a great time.
So are you.
Every day that I know you, I admire you a little bit more every day. Every day I say to myself, this little kid is exactly the kind of person I want to be. I mean, let's face it, you're the best thing that ever happened to me. So don't worry so much.
Yes.
Don't worry so much.
Don't worry so much. That is Dee Dee Tate, his mom's wisdom that she passes on to him. She's not an intellectual, and yet she loves him so much and has so much to inspire him with. That film really is the story of my life, I suppose. Somebody who's caught a young boy, or in this case a young boy, who's caught between the struggle of his heart and his head. And he is in a genuine spiritual crisis, much like all my movies are about people in spiritual crisis and the resolution that comes out of that. You know, he comes to understand that he doesn't have to choose between them, that he can have his head and his heart. And in some ways, in the form of these two women, his mother and his teacher.
To Catherine in Holland, Michigan. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your whole career. I'm just about the same age as you, Ms. Foster. And my first, I have to say, my kids, who are much younger, of course, adore. I always have to take it out of the library. That's a big hit in our house. But in your later work, I particularly love Nell and Little Man Tate also. And the scene that struck me the most in that movie is at the end with the two birthday cakes and the birthday party and the look that Dee Dee gives of exasperated tolerance. As Diane Reese's character unintentionally shows her up one more time, I always think of that when I think of you.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for your work.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that is, I think that really epitomizes the end of getting to the end of this struggle between the head and the heart. Now those two things come together in these two women.
You know, it's interesting how often we've heard it said that actresses or actors should never be in a film with a child because they always steal the film. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that way?
All the more reason to be in a movie with a child. I love the authenticity of children, and I love the fact that they do it for one reason, because they like to. And if they don't want to throw the bowl of spaghetti again, they will not throw that bowl of spaghetti again. And I find that really refreshing. I love that, that it's very pure. The process of working with them is very pure.
You are a risk taker, are you not?
I don't know. I think that's nice of you to say that. I don't know. Sometimes I don't know. I think that I am in my work. Yeah, I think I am in my work. And I think that unless I am doing something that I believe in fervently, I don't trust it. And I don't trust that I will have the talent to really do anything extraordinary on screen. So unless I am struggling for a cause or a movie or an idea that I love passionately more than anything else, I just don't believe that I'll be any good.
Actress, director Jodie Foster, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Good morning, Jodie.
Yes.
I feel like I've known you like you're a dear friend that we've known for years. Those shooting star that fell into my eyes and through my body, not to forget you, to endure.
Wow.
That movie, I saw it 15 years before I had my own gifted and talented son, and he's in the top 2% in science and math now.
Wow.
And I just feel like I know you because we've grown up together, and I watched your TV shows and watched all of your films, and you have carried me through. I sincerely don't know what I would have done without you.
Wow, thank you. Thank you.
You're just gorgeous in so many ways, and there's just so many times that you've hit the pulse about what I feel and think about life in your films.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I mean, it's a personal thing. I do a personal thing for a living, and I guess I do. I enter into people's homes, and it's a very intimate thing to make movies. And it's why you have to not sign on to make movies you don't believe in, because, you know, it has consequence. And thank you very much for all of your nice thoughts.
Finally, to Matthew in Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Hello.
I just had a quick question. Jodie, you have always been in wonderful films, and my favorite one of yours is Contact. What did you do to prepare for such an intense and beautiful role that I believe has really changed me as a person and my views as far as science and religion?
I think that film probably had more research than any movie that I've ever done. I spent a lot of time with astronomers, with people working with radio telescopes. I spent a lot of time reading about science, something that does not come naturally to me, that I'm fascinated by, but it does not come naturally to me. I spent quite a bit of time with Carl Sagan as well, all that immersion really just helps you be as connected as the character is to her passion. And she was absolutely passionate about science and about the possibility of life in other places and the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
And of course, at the other end, your role in Nell, which I just saw again the other evening, developing that kind of otherness. Yeah. Language.
It's an odd film. It's a film, you know, originally it was a play, and so it does have a theatrical quality to it, even though it's in this natural environment and very naturalistic movie. There is a theatrical quality to the conceit. A woman is raised in the forest on her own, and she has never seen anybody. She's never been outside this home, and she develops a language on her own, and it's the sort of mystery, the unraveling of this man who comes to her to find out things about himself. Could I be alone? Who would I be if I didn't have this ex-wife and if I didn't have this, you know, all this stuff? And what he comes to learn is that what he thought about her is completely wrong, that when he unravels the mystery, that mystery of the language leads him to understand who she is, which is exactly the opposite of who she thought, of who he thought she was. So that's, it is kind of a theatrical conceit. It's not as naturalistic a movie as I think it looks visually.
And last quick question. Someone wants to know whether your children show any propensity toward acting.
No, my kids have no interest in acting, and they show no propensity for it. But they do love movies, and that I'm grateful for. I've just started showing them films of mine. They've never seen anything of mine besides Bugsy Malone and Nim's Island. Those are the only two films of mine they've ever seen.
Jodie Foster, director, producer. Her newest film is The Beaver, starring Mel Gibson and Jodie Foster. How wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you very much. It was great seeing you.
Thank you. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.